Hi, this is Jay Abraham, and I'm here with my partner, Rich Sheffrin. Rich?
Hi, Jay.
And we want to welcome you to the first of what we think is going to be a lifetime journey we're going to have together with these amazing panel interview sessions. Today is probably going to be one of the most important, and it should be, as our first real interactive experience. The title is Getting Customers to Always Choose You Over the Competition. And Rich and I have gone to extraordinary effort to bring on the panel the experts we think represent the broadest spectrum of deep, specialized understanding you could possibly gain access to. And truthfully, most of them you wouldn't have the ability to gain access to on your own, but we have the good fortune of having influence and access to people that have been very gracious to assist us. Let us now set you up for what the process is going to entail, so you'll know, not just for this panel, but for all the subsequent ones that we expect you to be experiencing with us for years to come. The process Rich and I use is very simple. We will introduce each one of the experts very quickly but very respectfully. We're not going to really talk to them yet. We'll wait and let them demonstrate to you their mammoth minds by the answers they provide to the questions we're going to ask. We're going to ask 7 questions normally of a panel. Each question we will ask to be answered by all of our panel members. In other words, we'll ask a question, and then we'll go to each one of our experts for their unique and specialized answer. Rich and I will take turns asking them because we want you to basically get very familiar with both of our styles. Sometimes we'll make comments. Sometimes we'll wait until the end. At the end, again, we will make an incredible interpretive assessment of what we've all just heard, what the big overriding lessons, issues, and insights and epiphanies are, and most importantly, what to do with them. Now, let us introduce to you our panel. First panelist I'm going to introduce is Jack Trout. Anybody who knows anything about marketing knows that he's probably the definitive man when it comes to positioning, when it comes to understanding distinction, differentiation. He and his company have offices all around the world. He has been either the co-author or the author of more important and impactful books about marketing than anything else, Positioning the Battle of Your Mind, Marketing Warfare, Big Brands, Big Trouble. He's been one of my heroes, and he's somebody whose understanding of the most critical elements of differentiation and positioning are unparalleled. He's going to bring incredible perspective to this. Rich?
Okay, Jay. Next we have Joseph Jaffe, and Joseph Jaffe is the resident, I love this, the chief interrupter of Crayon, that's his company. And Crayon is a very interesting strategic consultancy that teaches really small, medium, and the largest corporations around the world all kinds of ways to use social media and the derivatives to really maximize their reach, to maximize their impact, to deepen their connection with their prospects and customers, and ultimately to increase their success and their profitability. So he's written 2 books. Soon there will be a third. The first one was really Change the Landscape of Advertising, which was Life After the 30-Second Spot. It was extremely valuable when it came out. It's still valuable today. And it really talks about the transition from traditional advertising to more of the advertising that is done today. The next book he wrote was Join the Conversation, which is probably my favorite book on social media and its power. And it's really about how to connect and really understand social media and what you can do with it to grow your company. The one that is going to be coming out soon is Flip the Funnel, and I'm not going to be able to do it justice. He's just a master of understanding all things that pretty much anyone online is concerned about, whether it's social media, Facebook, podcasting, blogging, etc. And I would say he's probably the top expert that you would want to plug into when it comes to social media, and he's graciously conceded that he will let us pick his mind and really extract those nuggets of exactly what you need to do online today to help grow your business and really cement the bond and get chosen as the ideal for your customers and prospects. Next, we have Kevin Hogan. And Kevin is arguably the definitive, super colossal, uber master in the field of persuasion. He's written a total of 19 books, 19 different books on the subject of persuasion. The runaway one that everybody knows is The Psychology of Persuasion, and it's how to persuade others to your way of thinking, and he is just masterful out of it. Kevin's trained in the field of sales, marketing, leadership, members of government, as diverse as Poland. I'm curious as heck at what he taught them. What in the world he taught the U.S. Postal Service. I want to hear that, too. He's also taught Starbucks, Microsoft, et cetera. He's the definitive master, and we're going to have great fun with him, plumbing the depths of the catacombs of his very, very agile and knowledgeable mind. Back to you, Jay.
Okay, thank you. Our next expert, and a very, very, very provocative man. He's really got something extraordinary in his achievements. Michael Bosworth. He's a legend, and his background is very, very impressive. He got involved in selling disruptive technology in the very early stages, and he refined it. He expanded it. He became the preeminent expert source of understanding how to masterfully sell something very, very, very hard for people to understand. Over his career, he's developed probably the definitive understanding of solution selling, customer-centric selling. Those are the titles of his books, but they're more importantly the body of his life work. He understands the selling process, how to work with all the different influences you have to deal with in multi-influence selling, how to deal with all the different objections and issues that people subconsciously are struggling with as they're listening or reading or watching your sales presentation. He's really built some of the greatest distinctions. His probably biggest claim to fame is he mastered most of the sales strategy for Xerox, and he's now goes around the country teaching it. He's a very prominent venture capitalist, and he's graciously agreed to share his enormous wisdom in the selling and influence and persuasion area with us in the answers to his questions today. Russell Granger, another expert on our panel today. We've got an incredible dimension of understanding and expertise represented. He's a lifelong researcher in breakthrough areas of really the psychology of selling and success. But his latest book is of most interest to Rich and I. It's called Seven Triggers to Yes. And it goes really deep, and he goes really deep into understanding the new science of success and the awesome power that persuasion wields in the whole process. And some of the things you're going to hear from him are exceedingly fresh and enormously different than the old rhetoric that has been basically brandished about by a lot of the old-time thinkers. It's going to be really exciting. Rich?
Thanks, Jay. Next, we have Bert Decker, and he's one of the most influential personal coaches in the area of communication, believability, and ultimately effective presentations. His clients read like the world icons in business, investments, and in arts. He's had people like Chuck Schwab, the co-founder of Twitter, and major, major business magnates. He's really coached all types of people on really how to effectively get their message across. And he's written really the definitive and seminal books on that topic. The one that's really the classic of how to get your message across is called You've Got to Be Believed to Be Heard. And it's still considered the absolute Bible in credible communication. He works with really high-level and very impactful communicators at about every walk of life, in every type of business. You name an area where communication is critical, where the stakes are exceedingly high, and they bring him in. And so we're really pleased to have him on board, and I'm sure he's going to give everyone a perspective about really what you need to do to your message to make sure that it's believable and credible. Jay?
And rounding out our super panel today is somebody who's a very dear friend of mine and one of the most really, really deep and profound thinkers and researchers in the field of high-leveraged achievement. He's also the son of somebody very prominent, Stephen M. R. Covey, who's the son of Stephen R. Covey of Seven Habits fame. But Stephen, in his own right, is a remarkable man. He was the CEO of the Covey Leadership Center. He engineered the combination of Franklin Covey. But more importantly, when he went on his own, he researched the most important remaining facet of business leverage in the marketplace today and realized that it was trust. When you achieve trust, you sell quicker, you sell more people, you sell more frequently, you get more referrals, you shorten the sales process. He wrote a book called The Speed of Trust, and it has become the most influential, the most impactful, the most referred to business book in the last 2 years. And his take on this whole topic we are going to be focusing on today is going to give the final spin. So we're going to basically start asking a question, and then we're going to go through person by person their answer. And I think you're in for an extraordinary and a business-shifting experience. And again, at the end, Rich and I will then slowly and methodically tell you what we got out of it, what we think you should get out of it, and what you need to do to act on what you got out of it. First question, what's the single biggest strategy for moving from distrust, dubious and suspect, to seismic credibility? What's the single biggest action that our members listening should do first and why? And keep in mind, you got small, medium-sized entrepreneurs, and they interact and communicate through a number of different methods. Joseph, let's hear your thinking on that.
If ever there was a more profound way for any company to join the conversation, yes, but for small businesses to actually compete on a level playing field, this is that time. This is that opportunity. And I think that is a critical and a key takeaway. In my second book, instead of talking about the tactics, what I wanted to do was create a framework or maybe build a foundation on three strategic pillars. And those pillars are community, dialogue, and partnership. What's so interesting about these three buckets, if you will, is that they don't necessarily have to exist in a digital world. They don't necessarily have to exist in what I call a virtual world. They absolutely exist in the physical world, in the real world. You know, the ability for us, and again, any small business owner can appreciate this, to remember and recognize our customers by name, by number, by face, to remember what they ordered the last time they were in, to ask them how their kids are. That kind of dialogue, that kind of recognition, that kind of context in terms of being part of their community is what makes really small businesses tick and what makes them thrive and what makes them grow. Now, at the same time, in a digital world where we have databases and we have email newsletters and CRM and keyword buyers and all of these wonderful tactics that happen to have data and measurability and optimization, we have even more of an opportunity to kind of cheat, to cut corners, to remember exactly who our customers are, what they did last time, what their preferences are, what they like, what they dislike, and use that to better serve them. I think inherent in this different way to conceptualize the way the world works comes that third pillar, that third leg of the stool, partnership, to work with our customers as partners, to listen to them, to learn from them, to respond to them, to bring them into the actual R&D or innovation process. Through that ownership and that participation, realize that ultimate, you know, that elusive 1+1=3 end result.
All right, Jack, your answer, please.
This is a simple one. It is actually the answer to the subject of this discussion: getting customers to choose you over everybody else. How do you do that? Is essentially the biggest strategy, and the answer is very simple: it's differentiation. How do you differentiate yourself from your competition? That is the single idea.
Russell, let's hear your answer.
Forget the old ways of doing things. We're really off on an exciting new journey to success and profit. The great news is that for the first time in history, We have documented hard science breakthroughs that tell us precisely how to increase our credibility and trust. And perhaps even more important, we now know why it is so critical to our success to have that seismic credibility that Jay mentioned. With our clients, with our prospects, with our employees, our suppliers, yes, and even our bankers, everyone we contact. For the first time, we can document that most, if not all, decisions are made by our emotions, our limbic systems. Live brain neurological science has now documented a simple fact, and this is a, I hope, a takeaway from this session we're having. We are not thinking machines, we are feeling machines that think. And here's the key to the importance of credibility and trust. Science documents that all sensory input, including your requests for decisions and actions from other people, goes to a small element in the brain's emotion-based limbic system. And you got to remember this word. It's called the amygdala, which is the Greek word for almond. Now, the amygdala really is the focal point of our little chat today. The amygdala has two functions. It acts like a switch. The first function is to trigger an immediate emotional decision, and that is triggered by the internal database that we each have built up over our lifetime. If the amygdala's emotion trigger is not immediately activated, guess what happens? The amygdala sends the information, which is your request, to the prefrontal cortex for lengthy and literally painful rational cognitive evaluation. You get a delayed response, if any. What do you want from people? You want a quick, easy, automatic response, and that's what we're going to help share with you today. Now, here's the all-important key as to why credibility and trust are so critical to your success. This little part of the brain, the amygdala, is highly risk-sensitive. The flight or fight syndrome resides here. If you are not perceived as credible, trustworthy, the amygdala rejects your request and you don't succeed. You don't get what you want. So now let's talk about the how. We talked about the why and the fact that the amygdala is so risk sensitive. Let's talk about the how. The single biggest action you can take is to target your partner's emotions. The amygdala, not the logic, not the rationality of your presentation, not the great arguments, but you've got to focus on reducing risk for the amygdala. Now, how do we do that? Well, the first huge step is to be perceived as a friend. Find areas of mutual interest, mutual concern, mutual goals, shared ideas. The friendship trigger sets the stage for all emotional triggers to follow. Why? Well, because friendship bonding reduces risk for the amygdala. Friendship generates trust and credibility, and that's the question that Jay put to us. Actively search out areas of mutual interest. Bond with your partner. And here's another key. Be honest. Always. The amygdala can perceive trust and credibility when it perceives honesty. Another suggestion is to keep your partner first. Not your thoughts, not your ideas, not your requests. Ask questions, learn her values, learn the goals and the needs for your partners. Use these thoughts to reduce risk for your partner's emotion, the amygdala.
Stephen, what's your answer going to be?
I would say this, Jay. You always start with yourself by focusing on your own credibility, your own self-trust. See, because this self-trust precedes all the other kinds of trust. It's self-trust that precedes relationship trust and that precedes organizational trust and market trust. So by starting with yourself, your own self-trust, of being able to answer the question, do I trust myself? And being able to answer the question, do I give to others a person that they can trust, a leader they can trust, a partner they can trust? Am I that type of person for them? And how you'll best answer that, and how your customers and your clients and your partners and your employees will be most responsive in answering in the affirmative that they do trust you will grow out of your credibility. Credibility is a function of these four things. It's your integrity, which is referring to your honesty and your truthfulness. When your believable, so you have absolute integrity. It's also, the second one, is your intent. Intent is referring to your motive, to your agenda, and to the behavior that follows. And the intent that best builds credibility and trust is when you're seeking mutual benefit, when you win-win. Yeah, I want to win, but I want your win as much as my own. When people believe that, when they see that, when they sense that, when they experience that, you become more credible to them. Those first two, they flow heavily out of your character, you know, integrity, being honest, intent, your motive. That comes from your character. The next two cores of credibility, they come from your competence. And that is, the third one is your capabilities. Those are referring to your talents, your skills, your expertise, and your knowledge. And the key question here is, are you relevant? Because if you stay relevant, you'll stay credible. But if you lose relevancy, you'll lose ultimately the credibility that you have. So you always are getting better, improving, staying relevant and current in the market and in your role or your responsibility. And then finally, the fourth core of credibility is your results. That's your performance, your past performance, and your current performance. So those four dimensions, integrity, intent, capabilities, and results, if you start there with your own personal credibility, as well as then your company's credibility, that's a better starting point. Because once you have credibility, then you can build trust very fast by following the credibility with good behavior. But without that credibility, you'll never be able to build or sustain that trust in the long run. So I always say to people, where do you start? Start with yourself and start by building your own credibility personally.
Bert?
Well, you might not be surprised at this coming from me, since I've been in communications all my life, but it is, and I say this to everybody, it is to speak out publicly and often and get feedback. A lot of people know that they should use speaking and get out there in the marketplace, particularly with their clients, but in a public venue, you have higher leverage. But the real problem I find is people do not get feedback, and that is the single most important thing. And I'm not talking, Jay and Rich, about just public speaking, although I do encourage people, that's where you're going to get the highest leverage. I'm talking about the touch points you have during a day, considering them as messages, considering them intentionally, making the unconscious communications you do conscious, so that you're able to be more effective, more persuasive, make the emotional connection, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But while doing it, also get feedback. When people do that, they're going to get confidence and skill. Can't stress confidence enough. As a matter of fact, it's kind of interesting because when you look at, I use several examples of confidence or lack of confidence, and you see a lot of people on the pop show American Idol who don't go that far because of a lack of confidence. And those who are confident tend to go much further because people will believe they have the authority, whether they do or not. And, of course, you do want the authority and content, but you want the confidence above all. So it's really, if I had to give one thing, high leverage, immediate, speak out, be conscious about your speaking out, and do it often, and get feedback.
Kevin?
If you think about it, you want to start with distinction, okay? And one of the things I asked you right before we got on the line was, did you coin the phrase unique selling proposition? And the reason is because that's such a important phrase nowadays in the language of business. And it turns out that I think I have it right that you really found it from a person who had not probably done very well in describing it. And you came out, you put a diamond edge on it, and you made it well known to everybody. Okay, so if there's something I think of when I think of Jay Abraham, it's USP. You brand yourself. There's other experts that will talk to you guys about all that kind of stuff. The next would be to get written in your field, to write something that matters. You know, there's a lot of people that talk about doing the book is the business card idea right now. All of a sudden, you know, it's like when you get published, people look at you with a higher perception. But now I see a lot of the junk out there today that people have taken this idea and misused it. And so instead of me saying get published, I'm going to say get published with something that matters, okay? Be not only derivative, everybody can be derivative and borrow other people's work, but put the diamond edge on it so you do something that's really super important. You want people to come to your business or to come to your website. The question of trust shouldn't come to the mind. There should be so much available information that they can just immediately scout you out, pictures of you, video of you, anything that puts you out there so there's nothing hidden about you. You are there. You may not look good. You may look goofy or weird or you might be more complex than the average person, doesn't matter. But when your name is attached to it, you want people to know who you are in every aspect, so you have the same Microsoft, Apple type of a branding ability. And the more you let people know about you, the less questions are there, especially the weaknesses.
Mike, let's hear your perspective.
I think the major thing for everyone internally, especially if you're starting your own business or growing your own business, is to reevaluate and redefine your own concept of selling. The Gerhard Schwantner, the founder of Selling Power magazine, was quoted a couple years ago that the CEO's definition of selling influences the customer experience. It's the DNA of the customer experience. The traditional paradigm of selling in corporate America, in the enterprise solution marketplace where I've spent most of my time, selling is convincing, persuading, overcoming resistance, getting the prospect to close by the end of your quarter. It's convincing, persuading, overcoming, and the number one negative word buyers come up with when they think about the idea of being sold is pressure. And people hate feeling pressure. Engineers hate that definition of selling, and I've been asked to help organizations improve their selling where all their salespeople were engineers because their product is so complex they can only ask an engineer to sell it. And engineers love to solve problems. And once I realized that true selling, from my perspective, is helping your potential client visualize how if he or she had your offering, it's a product, it's a service, whatever, if he or she had your offering, how they would be able to achieve a goal, solve a problem, or satisfy a need. Now an engineer can be all over that because engineers love to help customers solve problems. When you're selling something disruptive, and most entrepreneurs have a better mousetrap. That's why they're starting a business.
Yes.
But they're selling something where they have superior knowledge than their buyer. And so they're approaching it from helping people do something that the customer never thought they could do before.
That's a great start. Rich?
Yep. Okay, so there are two aspects to credibility, quick fix and long-term remediation. So what actions would you recommend that could be taken quickly, and what actions would you recommend that are more long-term and self-sustaining? Joseph?
I often say to people, actually, the first thing you should do is nothing, which is to actually listen. You know, as the saying goes, God gave you two ears and one mouth, and it's time you use that in direct proportion. But I think that's one kind of more, cunning type of answer. It is to listen and learn and therefore know what to do next. But in terms of very specific tactics or next steps, you know, the one thing to do is, and I'll give you a bunch of them, one is to set up Google alerts or Yahoo alerts and put in certain keywords and phrases and make sure that whenever anybody's talking about you or your competitors or your category, you know about it almost as quickly as they do. It's easy, it's free, and it's ridiculously effective. The second thing to do after you've actually been able to do that is, you know, register your name or your domain or your certain keywords on the likes of, you know, Facebook and Twitter and Flickr and all of these sharing and social applications, because you definitely don't want it to be registered by somebody else, especially your competitor or someone that's really going to use it in a less than toward way. Longer term, I often tell people that the seeds of conversation are not magic beans. Oftentimes, I talk to people and they expect instant results, instant community, just add water. It doesn't work that way. So instead of the magic beans that sprouts the giant beanstalk, I think this is about being in it to win it and being in it for the long haul and making that commitment, you know, to use the analogy of giving, making sure there's ample sunlight and water and protection from the crows, and nurturing and providing that love and that commitment over time that turns a seed today into a giant impregnable oak tree tomorrow. I feel like, you know, the Brothers Grimm with all of these different parables here. But why would you walk away from the goose that laid the golden egg? Why would you not join a conversation that you have a point of view about that, that you absolutely can add value, that you can participate and even be a key player. So I think that's one part of the answer. The other part of the answer is if there is misinformation or distrust by not responding to it. Let's talk about just something as simple as a negative blog post or a complaint or a piece of criticism. By letting it fester out there, by just ignoring it and pretending that it goes away, can add to so much more damage down the road. I'll give you a quick example again. There was recently a very talked about case where two employees at a Domino's Pizza created a series of really, really disgusting, and I mean literally disgusting videos about what really happens in the kitchens at Domino's, and they put it on YouTube, and long story short, it literally erupted in a massive storm in the blogosphere and on Twitter, et cetera, et cetera. And the CEO and the corporate communications people at Domino's chose not to issue a press release because they didn't want to tip their hand and alert people that didn't know about the incident to it. They hoped it would go away, but it didn't, and it made the major news outlets and hit the mainstream media. And if they had, in fact, in that particular case, been proactive about addressing what had happened and the rumors, et cetera, they might have been able to at least deal with it on their terms, or at least on equal terms, as opposed to then being on the back foot.
All right, Jack, your answer.
What you've got to do is, number one, start with your competition, find out where they're strong, where they're weak, and look for that point of difference vis-a-vis your competition. Then you have to then essentially, once you find that idea, the next thing up is credentials. Now, you call it credibility. I would say credentials. In other words, how do you support your point of difference? Now, this can vary. I mean, there's a bank, Commerce Bank in the Northeast, which has since been sold, but they were Commerce Bank. You know, in essence, they said we're America's most convenient bank. Convenience was their point of difference. And they changed their hours. They did a lot of things to deliver that idea. But the real credentialing piece that happened was J.D. Powers did a survey. And it said they were essentially, they scored number one on a J.D. Powers survey for convenience. So, in other words, credentials or credibility comes usually with a third party involved who sort of says, no, these guys are the best at that. Or it could come from, you know, a long list of customers or happy customers, whoever. But what you've got to do is come up, once you say, here's what makes me different, now I need a set of credentials to support that point of difference. Because if you don't do that, all you have is a claim. That's the problem. So that's where credibility comes in.
Russell, what's your perspective on this?
I think one of the really great examples of the short route to persuasion is from Caesar Augustus. Now, he activated the authority trigger for credibility with just three words: Veni, Vidi, Vici. I came, I saw, I conquered. And with just those three words, he established his authority, the emotional reasons why the Romans should join his legions and follow him. Caesar Augustus used these three words at the beginning of each and every speech he ever made, for each presentation, and he immediately established his credibility to all. He didn't have to go into all the data. He hit their emotional trigger. He was a credible winner, a leader, and that triggered people to follow him. How do you take that short route? Well, like Caesar, let your contacts know immediately, right up front, who you are and what your qualifications are. It's pretty simple. If you have academic credentials, CPA, MBA, MD, PhD, CPCU, JD, anything like that, let people know. Put these accomplishments everywhere. Put them on your business card, your letterhead, your website, and let people know. Broadcast the fact that you are credible. Titles generate power. When you combine the friendship trigger with the authority trigger, up front and early, everything else you do becomes so much easier because you allay that risk sensitivity of the emotional system. All right, let's transition here to the long-term and self-sustaining actions to maintain that credibility. So when you do your homework up front and let your partner know it, you will gain long-term long-term credibility. Another thing that you can do to grow the credibility long-term is to document the success that you have achieved with others in a situation similar to the one that you were in the persuasion process about. If you need to, bring in other experts. You can bring them in physically, by consultation, or by research. If you don't have the answers, don't try to BS your way through it. Get the experts. Another idea is to collect and share endorsements about the good work that you have done for others. And this is a super long-term credibility builder. And guess what? When you get these endorsements, you can use them forever. This is an area that a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of small business people fail to realize how valuable this is. The next thing you might do is to write blogs, articles, white papers, anything that you can do to get your area of expertise known and to share this information with other people. You can collect pertinent information from other blogs and articles and email them to your partner on a regular basis. And always remember that others respond with unthinking, automatic compliance when we perceive authority, credibility, and trust.
All right, Stephen.
If you want to build trust fast with somebody, make them a commitment and then keep them. Keep it. Make another commitment to them and keep it. Make another and keep it. Repeat that process. Make, keep, repeat. Make, keep, repeat. It becomes an upward cycle. You can build trust. You can actually build it far faster than you might think. But be careful, because if you make the commitment and then break it, you'll also lose the trust faster. So you can lose it overnight. Now, if you keep doing that long term, that will you'll build a reputation and a brand that becomes so strong. And so for all of us to build that kind of track record of credibility, of results, of really doing what we say we're going to do, where it becomes part of your reputation, part of your personal brand or your company's brand, that, you know, if XYZ company says they're going to do it, they will do it. You can count on that. That becomes talked about. It becomes buzzable, and it precedes you. And with that, you build trust extraordinarily, both fast, but you also can sustain it. So really, it's the same answer to the question. It's just on the front end, you know, to do it fast. You want to do it fast? Make a commitment and keep it. Make another commitment and keep it. Over time, how do you get that type of sustainability approach and the long-term approach? Well, you have built that kind of reputation and brand through your behavior, consistently manifest over time, where you have this long-term track record of results, this long-term track record of this kind of credibility, and then that becomes your reputation, your brand. It precedes you, and it's an extraordinary, almost like it's a magnet to attract people, employees, partners, customers, but it also, it cuts through all the noise and all the clutter that's out there all around you, because you're a person that they can trust. And there's so much noise and clutter, so people in a time of a lot of noise and clutter, they look to someone that they can trust, to a name they can trust, to a company they can trust, to a brand they can trust, to a person they can trust, to a leader they can trust.
Bert, what's your answer?
Well, there are two things that I'd recommend people do quickly. One is to, going back to feedback, get on video right away. Get a flip video, whatever, or everybody probably has a DV video or DVD video now. But get to see yourself, because observe behavior changes. So that can be done right away. It doesn't even have to be a presentation setting. It could be a mock presentation. It could be a rehearsal. But people really need to know all of the cues, and I'll get into a few of them later on that they give off, where you will gain credibility or not according to how you act and behave, as well as, of course, your content. Now, I'm going to add another piece. This will seem a little self-serving since we do communication courses. But I would recommend that anybody who has not done a communication course that has video feedback, like we have a 2-day Communicate to Influence course, which is ideal for it, but there are a lot of people out there doing good work and good communication courses. You really need to do a course and get professional coaching, because we are not aware of how we actually come across. Long term, people need to get continuous feedback from others. There are three types of feedback. People feedback costs nothing and can do it all the time. What I recommend that people do, whether our clients or not, everybody on the call who is an entrepreneur, who is in touch with their public and their clients often, just give people some 3x5 cards after a sales pitch or a call or a speech or something like that, and just ask three keepers, as we call them, three pluses, and then three areas that I can improve in. The person writing those down or giving them to you, and it's better to write it down, just a few trigger words. The person who is giving you the feedback, they don't have to know what is right or wrong. They don't have to be skilled and conscious about all the communication elements, but they will give you what is top of mind. And if you get a lot of people saying, gosh, couldn't hear you, got a low voice, quiver in your voice, that kind of thing, you say, better do something about my voice, better listen to my voice. So if you get 3x3 feedback from people, that doesn't cost anything. You can do that right away and long term.
Kevin?
If you had to break credibility down, and that's really what this call is about, is credibility. There's really like a half a dozen things, and they're competence, you know, competence, like what you really do know, okay? And again, perceived is different than real. Trustworthiness, you know, is the person, you know, Doug Hall, who wrote Jumpstart Your Brain, always called it trustworthiness is timeliness. Is the person on time? That's more important than anything. Dependability. Is the person going to be there when they say it? If they are, you are in Flynn, you can trust that person. That's huge. Three would be expertise. Different than competence. Expertise has knowledge attached to it. Likeability is number four. When you do all the research, likeability is huge. People who come off as non-threatening or gentle or friendly or funny or confident, they're likable. We just like to be around those people. Composure. You know, like the Miss America contest and all that, you know, is the person poised? Can the person stand in front of a room or in front of a group or on a telephone call without totally blowing the whole thing? And then is the person extroverted? When you do the psychological research, that breaks down as big. Extroversion is pretty huge. So people don't want to necessarily do business with a lot of introverted type people because they perceive them as incompetent and uncredible. People want to start with credibility as themselves. We put so much just on the marketing side of credibility as putting it out there as, oh, we have great customer service. Screw that. Let's start with, like, who are you as a person? Are you a good person? Do you, like, care about the people that you hang around with? Do you care about the people you do business with? Do you really want your customer to do as well as they possibly can?
Mike, I'm curious to hear your thinking on this.
Well, in keeping with my definition of selling, the short term would be to think about what conversations you or your people, your salespeople, your marketing people, your frontline people are going to have with potential customers in order for your offering to get sold, funded, and implemented. So you come up with a targeted conversation list. So, for instance, if I were selling a enterprise CRM system, I know my salesperson's going to have a conversation with a chief financial officer about reducing sales costs. I know my salesperson's going to have a conversation with that same chief financial officer about his or her being able to do a more accurate revenue forecast. I know my salesperson's going to have a conversation with the VP of sales about shortening the sales cycle. They're predictable conversations based around the usage of your product. And once you do that, then brainstorm, sit down with all your smartest people and get out a flip chart. And for each targeted conversation, come up with some potential situational for that person product usage visions. That particular job title, every Friday before he goes home, if he had our product, would be able to do such and such. So try and form it in the usage by the customer of your product. That's short term. Long term, take that same product usage paradigm shift into your actual product training, not only for your new employees, but for your customers. Most companies, when they teach their product to anybody, whether it's customers, new employees, or the marketplace, they're putting it out there as nouns. What it does, and it doesn't do anything. So if they could switch to a customer usage vision of their product, product by product by product, that's the long term. That will revolutionize not only the startup time for new employees, but it will revolutionize the implementation of their products by their customers. It'll speed it up dramatically.
Next question, Jay.
Most all the people listening, the entrepreneurs, small business owners, professionals, you know, they don't think of themselves as not being credible, trustworthy, believable, connected. So what's the best way for them to get themselves a more unbiased viewpoint of what they're really conveying to their marketplace, and how do we develop thick enough skin to accept it, you know, appreciate it, and proactively benefit from it?
Joseph?
I'll speak personally as an entrepreneur. You know, I trade. I have to trade on the belief that I know what I'm talking about. Otherwise, why would I do this? And it can be immensely and intensely humbling when somebody calls you out. So learning, you know, so putting yourself out there and being prepared to be criticized or debated is a great grounding. Means of grounding oneself and staying down to earth while still, you know, reaching for the stars, so to speak. So that's how I interpret that question, which is, you know, the best way sometimes is to put something out there and have people respond, whether it's great post or you don't know what you're talking about. And through blogging and podcasting and now having my own video show firsthand, I get a sense of whether I'm on the money or whether I'm completely delusional. And that helps kind of ground me and focus me in terms of how to improve.
All right, Jack, your answer, please.
They got to do some what I call perceptual research. In other words, what you've got to do is get a list of customers or prospects. You know, it doesn't have to be, you know, cast of thousands. It could be just a selected list of what you think is representative. And what you got to do is go out to these people on a blind piece of research, and however you want to conduct it, you know, whether it's letters or online or whatever. And essentially, you go to this list and you say, we'd like you to sort of line up. This is no more than 90-second questionnaire. As a short thing, and you say, look, we'd like to get your observations on this group of companies, as you versus some competition, and against a group of attributes. And obviously, and those attributes tend to represent, you know, what your category, you know, represents. And then you ask these people to score it on a sort of a 0 to 10 scale. And that'll give you very quickly how people perceive you versus your competition. Against things. Look, years ago, I did a lot of work for Papa John's Pizza, and back when they were a lot smaller, now they're a lot bigger. And they did every year they do some perceptual research on good tasting, you know, and quality and good taste in terms of pizza. That's what they did, and they scored that hands down. They kept winning that, which is what they were measuring was the idea of better ingredients, better pizza. Mm-hmm. Which was the concept. And essentially the proof of that was how did their customers line them up versus Pizza Hut versus Domino's versus whomever. So it's understanding that perception in the mind.
Russell, give us your take on the question.
Most of us do not see ourselves as others see us. If you really want to know how you're perceived in the marketplace, and I strongly suggest you should learning that is easy. It's inexpensive. And it's very revealing and will lead to greater profit. If you Google the words, quote, online survey, unquote, you'll get over 69 million hits. So the suggestion is to try one of the more popular programs, like Constant Contact, for example, and you can get the full unlimited survey program that costs only $5 a month over their regular subscription. It's very easy to set up. It's easy for respondents to answer, and hey, it's easy for you to tabulate. It's a great way to find out what people are really thinking, and you do want to know that. There's another one called SurveyMonkey.com, and it's another popular format, and it, too, is inexpensive and easy to use. There are literally hundreds more free and fee-based programs, and it's critical to know how you, your company, and your products and your services are perceived. And the good news is today, it's easy to find those perceptions. Here's a little caveat, though. However you conduct your survey, be prepared for the worst. A president of a multi-billion-dollar company business that I reported to went into literally months of depression when he learned the truth about others' perceptions of his credibility. Their answers may surprise you, and they will also provide you with ways to grow and prosper. First of all, don't take it personally. Accept reality. Realize that the complaints, the problems, and the issues are about their perceptions, not necessarily about you personally. And recognize that there are things you can do and must do to change. You don't need to change yourself. You need to change the things that people are giving you information about. Recognize that this is a learning experience. It may be a tough learning experience, but it's valuable. The responses give you a great opportunity to correct, change, or tweak issues that are now negatively impacting your success. Remember, what you don't know can and probably will hurt you.
Stephen, what do you think?
You can go at a variety of different levels at this. At one level, it's a gut feel of, you know, how you doing, how do you feel like the trust is there, to a more direct approach of just really asking and saying, you know what, it's important. I've learned that in these relationships as a partner here, as, you know, working with you as a partner or working with you as a customer, that if we can build a relationship of trust, everything is better for all of us. Things work better. It's faster. There's less cost. It's more pleasant, more enjoyable. And we can sustain it. So that's important to me. I imagine it's important to you. How are we doing in this regard? And what can I do to increase the trust? See, you just basically ask. You don't need a survey or a tool to do that. You can just ask. And then finally, you can elevate it to even a more formal process where you do survey and you do this systematically and you tell people, hey, we want to know how we're doing, how trusted we are, and what we need to do more of, and what behaviors you need to see more of to build that trust. And how do you get the courage to do this? How do you get the thick skin, to your point, Jay, to do this, to expose yourself? Well, two things. First, you come back to the fact that you know it's economic, that if you're not fully trusted, that you're paying a price for that. There's a cost for that. So you want to address these economic issues. It's financial. You can measure it. And how important that is, how trust affects speed and cost. But I'll tell you what, you brought this up, and I want to highlight it. I'm equally passionate about how the qualitative side of trust, of how it also affects energy and joy. And when the trust goes down in a relationship or on a team, in a culture with a customer, with a partner, when the trust goes down, the energy goes down, as does the joy and the satisfaction. But when the trust goes up in that relationship, on the team, with the partner, with the customer, the energy goes way, way up, as does the joy and the satisfaction. And that's equally exciting to me.
Bert, what's your take?
As a matter of fact, there's a great disparity of how we think we come across and how we actually come across to others. And we don't have a clue about it until we see ourselves in video. Observe behavior changes. Because once you see yourself, you can become objective and you can develop that thick skin. You won't be as sensitive. You'll see yourself as a delivery system much more so. The other thing that I've found very helpful in my career is to have mentors. Now, there are two aspects of this. One is to pick individuals and ask them specifically to be a mentor. And of course, you have to give them value, too. There's nothing in this world that if you don't give, you don't just want to take value, you got to give value, too. So think of things you can do for somebody who you respect, who is wise, who can give you coaching, who could be a mentor. Whatever community you are in. Like I'm in the communication speaking business. I'm a professional speaker, and I have a speakers roundtable has become a mastermind group, and we meet annually. And there are 20 of us, some of the elite speakers in the country. But we don't talk about speaking communications as much as we do about our lives and giving balanced feedback to each other. A mastermind group is very powerful, and I would recommend that as well. That people will begin getting an objective view of themselves from those two things.
Kevin, you're up.
When I saw that question, I was like, wow, that's good. And it is, because trying to find an unbiased assessment of your credibility is tough. I think that the best thing you can do is to build up legitimate expertise to start with and then work on the ability to communicate that. So why am I not going to Starbucks? Why am I not buying Microsoft? Why am I not doing business with Coca-Cola? It's because I have an opportunity to go to Kev's Diner or Jay's Bar or Rich's Saloon. It's like, wow, you know, I need to have something good going on there. I need some evidence, something to build it up to show me that that's really cool. And it's going to come down to to a first-time experience. It's going to come down to trust and then predictability. Will I have this cool time every time I go there? It's easy to say get the thick skin, right? But the fact is that criticism hurts because it's rejection. We all hurt like hell when people reject us, and we get angry and frustrated. And all I can say is accept the criticism. Just have integrity. Never give it up. Always be the brand. Always be who you are. Don't change from group to group. And then don't cave into pressure to be different than who you are, who you want to be, as once you invent yourself. And I think that that'll start perception of credibility. It's really tough when you're starting out because you have to compete with your competitors who have been doing business for a long time. So just work under the assumption that everybody should be distrustful of you and work from there.
Mike, your answer.
I think for entrepreneurs, and by the way, if you're an entrepreneur, I've done some angel financing. I'm part of a venture capital group, and I have been advising a number of young entrepreneurs and starting their new internet businesses lately. And one of the key pieces of advice I put in along the subject is on their business card, do not put CEO. Put founder. Because eventually you're going to be out looking for money, and the people who have money are going to think a lot more of you if you realize that you can look at yourself and say, hey, I've got a brilliant idea and I'm founding a company, but that doesn't mean I'm the CEO of a $10 million company or a $20 million company. The other thing I would say is that they have to learn to tell a little personal story about themselves anytime they're in front of any potential customer, and their personal story has to make them human. And if they can learn to do that, make themselves human, you know, tell the customer a story of their own learning curve and their own journey and how they went into a few bad places and wrong assumptions before they finally figured it out. And if they can make themselves human and not somebody on a pedestal, they're going to do a lot better.
Take it away, Ridge.
All right, so let's talk about specific tactics. How would you suggest our members make each of their contact points with their market more effective, whether it's customer service, marketing, advertising, or simply describing the attributes of their product or service? What can they do to improve performance?
Joseph, what's your answer?
The first point is you know, if you're going to participate in a conversation, make sure that you actually respond. If you're, you know, going to start a blog, make sure that when somebody comments on that blog, that you're there to respond to that. These are small things that oftentimes don't get acted upon. Here's another example. You know, if somebody criticizes or complains, you know, in a public forum, whether it's your blog or somebody else's blog, you're probably going to be very quick to respond to them. But what about the positive compliments? What happens when somebody actually waxes lyrical about how great you are? Do you typically ignore them? You probably do. I used to until somebody called me out for taking advantage of them, for not thanking them for their gratitude, for their thanks. So that was another lesson as well that I learned firsthand, but certainly advice I would give from a very tactical standpoint, which is everybody that speaks out, whether it's positive or negative, whether they are a promoter or detractor, deserves a response. So looking at that continuum from new media to social media, when it comes to new media, I think the goal is don't go in shallow. You know, go in deep. Make sure that there is commitment there. Make sure that you move beyond just putting a catalog online, that you're actually able to think about ways to take that consumption experience or that research experience to the next level. You know, the ability to actually sample the product is difficult in an online environment, but with 3D tools and 3D modeling, you can really take it to the next level. Putting reviews on a site and being able to enhance your commerce with increased functionality. Another great way to give your customers something more so that it isn't just a very cold, brittle, sterile transaction. It can be more of an experience. One of the things that I often say today, and I talk about the fact that that markets, if you think about the ancient bazaars of yesteryear, you know, going back to Aladdin, I suppose, or the story of Aladdin, you know, there were five senses that were always in action at the same time. You could food was being cooked. You could smell it. You could taste it. You could hear music, the snake charmers. You could see people juggling the balls. People were pickpocketing. People were negotiating and haggling. There was noise. There was laughter. There was shouting. There was so much life associated with buying and selling stuff. But today, everything is so clean and so sterile. The malls are so clean, you can eat off the floor. You could pretty much eat off the toilets' floors, although I wouldn't recommend it. I think the point is our websites have become that equivalent. They're cold, they're sterile, they're inanimate. There isn't conversation happening there. And that's where the second part comes in, which is the social media component, the ability to really engage customers, but not only on a one-on-one basis, but indeed through their communities as well, and have conversations that aren't always about buying and selling stuff, but are about building relationships. You put that all together, you have a pretty sweet 1-2 punch.
All right, Jack.
What they can do is, number one, come up with a singular point of difference. What's your idea? What is it makes you unique and different? Once you have that in hand, then you build that concept into every point of contact, whether it's a sales call, whether it's an ad, whatever form of communication, that idea should be. Even your damn calling card should carry that idea. So, in other words, what you're saying is, it's not a question of doing something different at each point of contact. It's sort of taking the same idea and bringing it to life at every point of contact so that people get a sense of, service. If service is the whole thing, well, then you have to bring that idea to life, whether it's on a phone, whether it's in person. If service is your concept, every point of contact should just drip service, shall we say, and care and whatever. So that's the key. Where the mistakes are made is everybody doesn't have that singular framework that essentially you should be communicating it in every way, shape, or form you can. I mean, it's funny. I tell people, where is it on your calling card? What do you mean? Well, I'm going to put it on my website. No, I want it on everything. So that's the deal.
Russell, what's your perspective on this?
Specific tactics for marketing, sales, customer contact, advertising all involve the skill of persuasion. Thanks to the new scientific discoveries, you can easily become more effective in each and every business contact point. The key to becoming more effective in each of these contact point situations is to learn, plan for, and then activate the emotional triggers that form the internal navigation system in each and every person you contact, whether it's directly or indirectly, face-to-face, whether it's on email, whether it's on the telephone. Recognize that you want to target the amygdala. You want to target the emotional system, and that's the best way to get your information across. Forget the old ways that we were taught. Forget trying to be an effective motivator, influencer, persuader, or leader with data, reason, and logic, and great arguments. Because for the first time, we know definitively that the human brain just doesn't make decisions or take actions based on logic and reasons. The more specific tactics are to list each of the 7 emotional triggers listed that we have listed in the 7 Triggers to Yes and in the book and in the training program. Then evaluate each of these elements of each trigger. And there are probably 15 to 20 elements for each trigger. And these are the specifics that you really ought to do before any presentation, any face-to-face situation. And determine which of these trigger elements will work best for each contact situation. This is a little bit of work. It's a little bit of homework. But it's the way that you will build the confidence in the other person that you are credible, believable, and trustworthy.
I want to just identify your 7 triggers because I like them so much. You've talked about the friendship trigger, the authority trigger. You've got the consistency trigger, the reciprocity trigger, the contrast trigger, the reason why trigger, and the hope trigger.
All right, Stephen.
Wow, that's a great one. Let me recommend this process that is extremely impactful. In any situation, in these key interactions, in these relationships, wherever you go, do a couple of key things. The first is declare your intent. Let people know what you're doing and why. And also, I would say declare your intent about your desire to make the creation of trust an explicit objective. So you go into a situation and say, look, it's important to me to build trust. It matters to me. See, I'm very upfront about this. I declare my intent to make the creation of trust explicit, deliberate. I want to build trust on purpose. And then the second thing I talked about earlier when I said to signal to people your behavior, you tell them what to look for and why. And I learned this from Doug Conant. He's the CEO of Campbell's Soup Company. And he told me he does this process. He goes, whenever he goes into any new situation, any new relationship with a customer, with a partner, with an employee, he tells them exactly that. He says, look, I want to build trust. If we build a relationship of trust, it's better for everybody. So here's one thing you can know about me. I always will keep my commitments to you. And if I make a commitment, I'll keep it. And you can count on that. And then he says that when he does what he says he's going to do, people recognize it, they see it, they credit it, and they build the trust extremely fast. And it doesn't have to take forever. It can happen very fast. And we've applied this with many situations, with customers, with partners, with suppliers, as well as with employees, with relationships. It works. And so that would be a great process that our listeners and our participants could do, especially as they work with a customer or with a partner, those three steps. First, declare your intent to build a relationship of trust. Second, signal your behavior. Tell them what to look for. And then third, do what you say you're going to do. You do those three things, you can build trust very, very fast.
Bert?
Everybody should have an elevator pitch about what they do. And not just about what they do, but think in terms of an elevator pitch, a 30-second to 1-minute brief description that can describe themselves, their business, a cause that they have, whatever it might be. And at the base of it, the first thing anybody needs to know is, what's my point? What do I want to get across? So many people tend to be chatters and tend to give features and ramble around a subject rather than getting right to the point. What do I want to accomplish here? So in an elevator pitch, which should be practiced, rehearsed, I don't mean memorized, but I mean you should always be thinking and refining, a 30-second, 60-second elevator pitch for those things important to you. It's very powerful when you are continuously thinking, what's the point here and how can I give value? And that is the way our messages should begin and then ultimately be delivered, long messages or short messages.
All right, Kevin, what's your perspective?
The first is customer service, right? And I don't know about you guys, but America and growing into Europe and other parts of the world, we appreciate speed. And I appreciate speed probably as much as I appreciate anything. So we try to get to help the people who need help as like quick as instantly as possible. One of the things I think that helped me build my business was is that we have this huge sense of urgency when customers have a problem. And I mean, it's like of any kind, we try very, very hard not to get to them that day, but to literally to get to them. Can we get to them within the hour? Can we get to them within the half hour? Can we solve it for them as quickly, as rapidly, as instantaneously as possible? One time a guy wrote and said, hey, Kev, I dropped the Science of Influence CD set in the bathtub. All 12 CDs. Would you replace them? I'm thinking, A, what are you doing with the Science of Influence in the bathtub? But that was none of my business, though. But we replaced them immediately. It's like, because that's what he asked, you know? And the customer's not always right, but more often than not. So that's the first thing is in customer service, move fast. Whenever, especially when you're early in business, because if you don't, there's somebody out there that will take care of them much quicker than you do. Don't make really goofy claims. So many people make amazing claims. Just be real, you know. Just tell people the truth in your advertising. That's a great contact point. It's huge. Marketing, advertising, customer service, be fast. Speak your brand. Be really clear. I know a lot of this sounds so, we've heard it before, but if people will do it, if they'll act quickly when the customer needs help, if they'll advertise and show that and show the testimonial, whether it's on the internet or on television or whatever, that's what people want to see. They want to see that they're taken care of like they're at home, like they don't have anything to worry about when you're doing business with Kevin or Jay or Rich, because we will take care of you, period. That's the end of the story. Now everything begins, like I say, from that point.
Mike?
Well, I think I touched on it earlier, but if we go back to the ability to focus on situational use of your offering, in other words, you have to be able to list who you're selling it to by job title, by vertical market. So situational use would be come up with examples in each of those targeted buyers of their daily life, some event in their daily life where if they had your product offering, they could respond to that event differently. And that's a specific tactic. So you can make a list of all your targeted buyers. You can make a list then for each targeted buyer of what specific events in their business life or their personal life on an hourly basis, on a minute-by-minute basis, on a daily, weekly, whenever. What do they run into situationally where today, without your product, it's much more cumbersome, costly, or difficult than it would be if they had your product?
Okay, Jay.
All right. If you were to give our members a single exercise, one exercise that would constantly put them on the path to growing their trust, their believability, connectivity, credibility, bonded relationship, what would you recommend, and what do you think the benefits that will compound and accrue to them from doing that? Joseph?
There are two ways of being able to test the waters. One is to do a very top line of what I call conversation audit. In other words, you know, by going and taking stock of some of the primary tools out there, the Facebooks, the YouTubes, the iTunes, the Twitters, et cetera, the Flickers, the Technorotis of the world, in other words, representing the blogosphere. That's one way to take stock, which is you walk away from that really getting a sense as to who's talking, you know, how influential they are, what kind of authority they have, what the sentiment is, positive, negative, or neutral, indifferent. And of course, the final part is exactly what they're talking about as well. So that's probably a good exercise. The other one is the equivalent of, you know what, if you want to get if you want to find a specific answer out, ask the damn question. So you can do it in your store. You know, how's my service? How's everything going? Is there anything I can do to make your experience better? We can also do that question and ask that question in an online environment and in a social media environment. In my second book, I actually spoke about AccuQuote, which is a company that deals in insurance. And they just asked that question. They said, how can we service you better? What is the one thing that we could do to make a difference? And literally, they got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of comments that started pouring in. You want to get an answer? Ask the question. And you know what? Be prepared as well to deal with the answer and also be prepared to actually do something about that answer.
Jack, tell us your answer.
They've got to really say, look, here's my idea. Now I want to measure it among my customers and prospects. How am I doing? So that's critical. And then also you got to, and obviously versus my competition. So that's very, very critical. But it really is finding that one simple concept and saying this is what I'm going to be. And and specialization is a very important part of that. In other words, what one thing do I do brilliantly because that's all I do, or for the most part, most of what I do. Focus, staying right with and not drifting off and trying to chase other people's business at some point in time. I mean, those are all the aspects of, you know, look, Marlboro, right? What are they about? Cowboys and Marlboro country for decades. Now, do you think that they should futz around with menthols and ultralights and stuff like that? That's ridiculous. Real cowboys don't smoke that stuff. So, in other words, you have to stay with what you are and not try to drift off and try to do other things that really, if they don't undermine your business, they don't make any sense to what you're doing. I came across an appliance, small company, the service appliance. And essentially, all they really want to do is focus on one type of appliance, which was really amazing and expensive appliance. And that's what their deal was. And that's all. And that was their claim to fame. This is what we specialize in. This is what we do. And we'll show up in a truck, and because we specialize on this one type of appliance, we got all the parts. You know, we're ready to rumble here. So in other words, yes, they're narrowing their marketplace, but they're also differentiating themselves from a lot of other appliance services because they're honing in on just one one appliance. And obviously it has to be in an area where there are a fair number of those appliances and things like that. But that's what I mean by setting yourself up in such a way that you can, you know, stay with one simple idea.
Russell, let's hear your answer.
The 7 Triggers to Yes lists 24 elements for the friendship trigger, and you can activate any, some, or all of these elements to create bonding. Let's use just one friendship element for this exercise, bonding through similar interests. If you take away nothing else from this interview, please capture this one. It has not only earned me great relationships, a lot of money, it has literally saved my life. Always ask every contact this easy, simple question. What do you like to do when you're not working so hard? This question is absolute magic. Over the years, I've had literally 100% response to that question. People love it, and they respond enthusiastically. I use it face-to-face, on the phone, email, every contact. I learn what they like, what their interests are, and I learn how to bond with them. I don't always share the same interests, but guess what? I usually know somebody who does. And if I know nothing about their interests, I ask questions. Will people open up to you? That's not the issue. Hey, try to get them to stop talking when they get going on this. Again, this is absolute magic. Does this element work? I needed an operation. I went to the world's top surgeon, the chairman of the College of Physicians and Surgeons at the top-rated New York hospital to do it. He was extremely selective about who he'd operated on, and I was not a good candidate. I was ushered into his office. I violated every rule I was told. I was told to be brief, right to the point, no small talk. He was a real curmudgeon, didn't have time. I started with the question that I hope you'll take from this interview. I said, Doc, what do you like to do when you're not working so hard? He literally glared at me as if I was nuts. He looked at me for a long minute, and he said, come here. And he ushered me around the desk, pulled up his yacht club website where a 65-foot ocean racer was featured, and said, I love blue water racing. Well, I'm not a sailor. I really hate sailboats. They get in the way of my powerboat. But I am a boater. We chatted about the joys and perils of boating. At every appointment, I asked about, and he regaled me with everything new for his boat. Because of the friendship trigger, even though I was not a good candidate, he operated on me, and thanks to the friendship trigger, I am alive today.
All right. Stephen?
I would say this, that let me build on my earlier answer, that I would, you'd always, with these folks, you ask, how are we doing? How am I doing? How's the trust account? What can we do to increase it? But here's what I would do with a customer. It comes down to, here's a great test with the customer that is really, really powerful. It's to ask this question. It's the ultimate question. Fred Reichheld, the business author, calls it the ultimate question, and it's this. Would you recommend our product or our service to a friend or to a colleague? Would you recommend this service to a friend? Would you recommend this product to a colleague? That's the ultimate question. And people that are detractors on a 1 to 10 scale, they're between, you know, 0 or 1 and 6. You know, they might be lukewarm, but that's really a detractor. And on the upper end, the promoters are people that are at a 9 or a 10. They're enthusiastically wanting to recommend you to a colleague or to a friend, your product, your service, your business, whatever it might be, or even you as a partner. See, They're promoters. People that are 7 or 8, those are the passives. You know, it looks like they're pretty good, but you know what? They're not champions. They're not promoters for you. So if you're not getting referrals, then, you know, you might ask, you know, why? You know, I'd love to earn enough trust. I want you to trust me enough that you're willing and wanting to refer business to me, and I'm willing to pay the price to get there. And I'm not asking you to give me referrals if you don't fully have that trust yet. So I want to earn that. What do I need to do to get there, see? And so you're not making it about you, not about them.
Okay. What happens when you ask yourself that question and you come up with a negative? You say, you know what? I don't really honor even my own commitments to myself, let alone those to others. What would you say?
In the same way that making and keeping a commitment to another person is the fastest way that you can grow trust with that person, so it is with yourself. Learn to make and keep commitments to yourself. Don't make too many. You can't keep too many. Don't make them too big if you can't deliver on it. Start small. I learned this one time I guess I learn this and relearn this all the time, and I have to almost come back to it. I remember one time we were doing a merger, and I was working round the clock for about a three-month period. I was going, I'm not kidding when I say, 18 to 20 hours a day, more likely 20, and I was just going nonstop because it was just an intense period. I remember going to bed at 2 or 3 in the morning and setting my alarm clock to get up, and I'd set the alarm clock, and then I'd say, I'm going to get up an hour earlier and go exercise. And so, I'd be setting the alarm clock at 5, going to bed at 2, and then the alarm would ring at 5, and I'd wake up, and I'd say to myself, you know what, oh, gosh, I'm too tired. I need the sleep more than I need the exercise. And I turn off the alarm until 6. And I did that night after night after night. And I kept, and morning after morning after morning, I would wake up, turn the alarm off, and say, I need to sleep more than the exercise. And I remember one night setting the alarm, and I was setting the alarm to get up, early to exercise. And I said to myself, why am I doing this? Why am I even going through this exercise, this ritual, as if I'm going to get up tomorrow when the alarm rings? I know exactly what I'm going to say. I'm going to say I need to sleep more than the exercise. I'm going to turn it off. And it had become a little bit of almost a joke for me, where it wasn't real. And I was going to break it. I said, you know what? I'm going to make the decision the night before, not the morning of when I'm tired. I'm going to make it the night before. I'll decide the night before, do I need to sleep or the exercise? And I'll make the decision. But if I set up for 5, I'm going to get up at 5. Or else I'll set up for 6 or 7 or whatever time I'm going to get up. But I'm going to set up for the time I'm actually going to get up. Well, I started doing that. And you know what? And I kept that little commitment. You might say, that's a little commitment. You know what? It was a little commitment. But it's in the little commitments that this self-trust emerges. And I started doing that. And it did not take me weeks and months. It was in a matter of days. I began to get a sense of clarity, of integrity, of power that emerged from that very little simple commitment of learning to make and keep a commitment to myself. So that's always the starting point. And then you can move from those smaller ones to bigger ones. But it gives you a great foundation of clarity, of integrity, and of power to do it.
Bert, what do you think?
Well, let me repeat the one thing and put it into an exercise specifically, and that's getting personal feedback from people or from the technology that we have available. I would recommend just going back to our behaviors, how we sound, how we come across every day. Now, the other thing about that, as far as an exercise goes, it is getting in a daily pattern of reading. I have found that the importance of books in our field, in the self-help field, and the communications field, and in the leadership field, it's critical to read books and read blogs. I encourage people to get involved with social media. That's not an exercise, but reading something every day would be an exercise if people put it into their minds, and that would begin getting them out there. I think everybody is obviously into the blogosphere, but you can't just forget about the importance of books themselves.
Kevin, I am eager to hear your take on this.
The first thing is that with credibility, you want to be both perceived as credible and you want to be credible, two different things. So just for the heck of it, if everybody just writes down on a piece of paper, cuts the old Ben Franklin line right down the middle, are you credible on one side? Are you perceived as credible on the other? That's where you start this. And then you take 7 areas of credibility, which are experience, are you informed, and then trained, qualified, skilled, intelligent, and an expert. Okay, so experienced, informed, trained, qualified, skilled, intelligent, expert. And then after you complete each question, you're going to ask yourself a question, which is, are you perceived as experienced? Are you perceived as informed? And just be brutally honest with yourself, because assume that your biggest critic is going to come out there and do this for you in public, which they will. That's your competition. Okay? So you go through this list on both sides of the equation. So you end up with 14 questions. Are you credible as far as information? Are you seen as informed? Are you seen as trained? Are you seen as qualified? Or are you seen as unqualified? And the areas where you're not, that's where you have no choice but to become educated within your field, your niche, whatever it is you're working on, and then fix it. And you got to fix it within yourself before the perception part, because if you don't, you will be called on it and people will They'll take you apart in public. And people should be nervous if they're not really credible in their field. So get that, whatever the expertise, the training, the certifications, the degrees, all that stuff is, just get it and do it, because there's a huge price to pay later on when you don't. You want to become the resource. You want to become what that phrase is, arguably one of the best. That's how I like to have my name introduced. It's like arguably one of the best at X. That's pretty cool.
All right. Mike, what's your spin?
If you think about it, people have right brains and left brains, and they use both sides of their brain to buy. Most organizations and most salespeople are focusing on the buyer's left brain, their need for facts and data and statistics and ROI numbers and things like that. But it's the right side of the buyer's brain that causes them to say, you know, this is a person I can trust. This is a person who really sees the world through my eyes. This is a person who's going to be there for me if things get tough. And now is really a time to do this. Those are all right brain decisions. And that's the biggest deficiency in most organizations in selling, is they are too much on the buyer's left brain and not enough on the buyer's right brain. If you hear most really good CEOs, they tell self-deprecating stories all the time. And so many salespeople go out there thinking that they have to be perceived as superhuman. And I think that's a big, big mistake. The more you can get human being to human being, I remember a guy I used to work with at Xerox. He was a psychology major, and he'd experiment at cocktail parties with people. And he says, now, if you go out and you're just at a cocktail party and you meet people, one of the things that comes up is, do you have any kids? And a person will say, do you have any kids? Yeah, me too. I've got three. The first one went to Cornell, and the second one did this, and the third one did that, and they're all wonderful. Well, this guy, he had five kids, so he would say, I've got five kids, one of each, and the first four, everything's on track. Great college, you know, nice relationships, et cetera, but boy, that fifth one. I've rehab, DUIs, getting in trouble, that last one's driving me crazy. Now, as soon as he admitted that his fifth child was deficient, what do you think the other person did?
Tell me.
They admitted that their fourth child was a problem, too. In other words, he got human to human.
Your turn, Rich.
Thanks, Jay. Of all the things that you've researched, written, and presented, what do you think is the single biggest distinction, realization, insight that you need to get across to this group that hasn't been covered so far, and why? Joseph, what's your answer?
The two things that typically that I run into the most confusion or sometimes concern about are control and criticism or negativity. The one thing is the letting go and the release of control, the cession of control from us to them, where us is the company or the business and them is our customers or consumers in general. There seems to be an incredible fear of what happens when you open up the kimono or let people peek into the sausage factory. Think about restaurants today. You know, for the most part, almost every restaurant you go to today has an open plan, or every good restaurant has an open plan kitchen. Why do you think that's the case? Well, certainly there was an entrepreneur somewhere down the line, or an innovator, that decided it might be cool to kind of introduce an industrial type of look and feel. But I think it also reassures people that, in fact, everything is clean and kosher, so to speak. Now, I don't know how many of your members, you've got enough members, so I'm sure the numbers are high, have ever worked in a restaurant. But as the saying goes, and I have worked in a restaurant, if you knew what happened in the kitchen, you'd probably never eat in any restaurant again. So that was a great way, through the power of transparency, and that's a big buzzword in my business, you know, authenticity, disclosure, but transparency, to actually demonstrate a sense of trust and credibility. And it comes from letting go a little bit. It comes from sharing a little bit and being prepared to deal with the consequences. Well, the other thing is negativity, you know, and it's like we want positive reviews. We want people to love us, but we can't deal with people who hate us. And I would argue and I would challenge people and say that, you know what, our biggest friends are people that hate us, because at least they care enough to hate us. They care enough to talk about us. They give us, for the most part, an opportunity to deal with them and turn them around and solve their problems. The people we should be most concerned about are the people that actually don't care, that have no, that are indifferent, that are apathetic, because they're the people that will forget about us in a heartbeat. So those are two things that I would cover.
Jack, what's your take on this?
What's the one single idea that small business people, middle, medium-sized business people, or even large business people have to understand and learn? And it's all about, this is essentially a battle of perceptions. The whole game out there is winning the battle for the mind, you versus your competition, and getting into the mind with that point of difference. And it's perceptions, and perceptions are reality, but it is perceptions. And how you, so understanding how you build perceptions, understanding how you, that what makes sense in people's minds, so that you can take advantage of, understanding perceptions of your competition versus you. Whatever size business you're on, you really are in that battle. It's not what you want to be, it's what you can be. In the mind of your prospect. So I would say that therein lies the, that's the most important thing that underpins just about everything I've done.
Russell?
So your takeaway from this interview is simple. It's really obvious. Do not make it painful for your partner to agree with you, to make the right decisions, to act on your idea or your proposal. Activate the emotional triggers and you'll get the quick, easy response without the pain and agony of a long, long cognitive decision when the amygdala sends it to the wrong place.
Stephen, what's your perspective on this?
I would say this, that trust and the ability to create trust is truly the one thing that changes everything. It's Jay's point at the outset that this is the last great frontier of extraordinary value creation. And the reason this is so vital is that trust affects everything, and it changes everything, and it's economic. It's not just some nice, soft social virtue. The reality is trust is a hard-edged economic driver. Why? Because trust always affects two measurable outcomes, always, speed and cost. And here's how the economics of trust work. When the trust goes down in a relationship or on a team, or in a company, or with a customer, when the trust goes down, you will find that the speed goes down with it. Everything will take you longer to do, and the cost goes up. Everything will cost you more to do. Why? Because of the many steps you have to take to compensate for that lack of trust. Now, this is a tax, a low trust tax. Now, thankfully, the opposite is true as well. When the trust goes up in that relationship, on the team, in the company, with the customer, when the trust goes up, you'll find that the speed goes up with it. Everything can happen much, much faster, while the cost comes down. Everything costs you less. Now that is a dividend, a high trust dividend. And it is really that simple, that real, and that predictable. Trust is always economic as well as social. And it affects everything else. And these economics are being played out everywhere. So if I can get good at trust, it'll make me do better at everything else I need to do. I can innovate better. I can engage my people better. I can attract and retain people better. I can create greater and deeper customer loyalty. I can also execute my strategy faster. I can partner better. See, without trust, you really don't partner. You might have vendors and suppliers. Without trust, you really don't have a team. You might have a group. It's trust that turns a group into a team and turns a vendor into a partner. It's trust that really makes everything work and move around, that solidifies the relationships. It's trust that really drives the sales, because people want to buy from those that they trust. And like Jay was saying at the front, they will buy more from those that they trust. They'll buy more frequently. They'll buy in larger volumes. They'll stick with you longer. They'll give you the benefit of the doubt. They'll refer business to you when they trust you. So trust makes everything better. And so why is this so vital? Because trust is the one thing that changes everything. If I get good at trust, it'll make me better at everything else I need to get good at. If I'm not good at this, everything else I need to do will be discounted, diluted tax.
Bert? So I'm going to mention two quickly. And the one I just thought of is that people think that if they say the words, people will get it. But it is just not so. And you see it continuously in sales pitches, in presentations, in actual communications, just casual communications with people. People connect emotionally, and it's absolutely important to realize that you're creating a communication experience with every person, whether you're on the phone, whether you're in person. And if we think of it that way, it becomes a very different dynamic between people and the communications between people. Leadership and communications, I think, are synonymous. I think sales and communications are synonymous. And that's why I continuously stress the importance of knowing how you come across, making the unconscious conscious. I think most entrepreneurs do know it unconsciously, intuitively. And my desire is to get them to know it consciously so that they can do something about it and take some of the realizations of how they come across and be more effective.
Kevin, what's your answer?
Now we're going to use credibility-loaded words. And there's one of the things that's fun to do in my field, which is influence, is to be able to test words and, you know, phrases that actually sell or don't sell or have impact or don't have impact. And with credibility, there's certain words that people will accept until they've been proven wrong. So, for example, like experienced or qualified or trained or skilled or intelligent, these are very similar to the prior experiment or the research project on yourself. Expert, informed, as seen on TV, still is unbelievably powerful in credibility, has 25 years of experience, all that kind of stuff. You want to use those kind of loaded words when you're describing yourself. So Jay Abraham has experience. He's got 50 years, maybe not 50, 40 years of experience, okay, in helping your company grow. Read some stuff on charisma and on inspiring people. Don't tell jokes. Jokes are terrible. People like to listen to people who are funny, but they don't like to hear jokes, and jokes tend to fail miserably. So just be humorous, okay? Find the times when people laugh and write them down, you know? That's why I always record everything. You guys should record everything you ever do, because every now and then you're funny, and then it's like record that information and go, ah, I was funny then, three people laughed, that I'm sticking with. And then you start to recognize what other people find as credible, as funny, as valuable, as likable about you.
All right, Mike, your answer?
Well, remember the 80-20 rule?
Yep.
It's really 87-13. There's a group called the Sales Benchmark Index, and last year they pulled in their statistics, and this is in the B2B corporate America. 13% of the salespeople are selling 87% of the business. With all the money people and companies have spent on self-improvement and sales training and training on closing and training on negotiation and training on marketing and et cetera, that 87-13 really tells you that corporate America has still not figured out how to institutionalize what the top 13% are doing.
Now off to Jay.
Of all the questions we did affirmatively ask, so what's the one question taking fullest advantage of your knowledge, expertise, and understanding that we should have asked you, whether it's related to this topic or not, I mean, the credibility, et cetera, and why should we have asked that, and had we have asked that, what would your answer be?
You know, people are always talking to me and saying, you know, about this idea, again, of going back to control, right? We're in control, or our customer's in control, or even the mighty Procter & Gamble will tell you that the consumer's in control. And I disagree with them completely, because nobody is in control. And I often say, and I'm not even trying to be, you know, flippant about it, but, you know, I mean, is the consumer in control? Because when last I checked, they were trying to save their house from being foreclosed on. So I'm not really sure if anybody in this world, in this recession, in this year, is in control. I think we all try to find order from essentially chaos. But that's one of those things about the fact that life is unpredictable. You know, life is non-linear. Life is fluid. Our consumers' lives are non-linear and unpredictable as well. And I think we as marketers, we as small business owners, we have to become speculative. We have to become opportunistic. We have to be able to deal with opportunity and contingency when they present themselves to us. And the more adaptive we can be and the more responsive we can be and the quicker we can move and move decisively, the more likely we're going to be or be able to be successful. Most of this is free, so when it comes to advice and being able to join, to continue the conversation, you know, I welcome everybody to kind of follow up, and I'll give you a variety of ways of doing that. So the first is, you know, in my corporate life, my company Crayon's website is www.crayonville.com, and that's V as in Victor, crayonville.com.
Give us your perspective, Jack.
I will tell you what the one thing, and I think this is a very, very important observation. This is said by Peter Drucker, the father of business consulting. This is, to me, the he's the best about, you know, working out a strategy, understanding how to run a business.
Yes.
And Drucker said many, many years ago, and he wrote this in one of his books, and he said, look, the purpose of a business is to generate new customers. Now, and everybody says, yeah, that's right. Well, now, there's only two functions in a business that do that, marketing and innovation. He said every other function is an expense. Now, let me tell you something. That idea is absolutely brilliant. It's absolutely correct. And it's an idea that has been totally missed by most of corporate America over the years. That concept has sort of drifted off into the shrouds of history. And yet, that's it, guys. It's, I don't care what kind of business you're in. It's marketing and innovation. In other words, how do I market myself? How do I build those perceptions? How do I differentiate myself? And then innovation. How do I keep it going? What new ideas can I cook up that sort of support that idea?
Yeah.
And that's it. I mean, that's the nut. That's the most impressive thing I've ever read. The beauty of new and improved, it never lets your competition get a beat on you. So you're always innovating out ahead of them. So in other words, people say, well, I can do that. Well, yeah, but that's old news. Let me tell you what the new stuff is. So that's what I mean by innovation. It's always staying ahead, one step ahead of your competition with a new or a better idea, whether it's a service, whatever it is. But that to me is what a good innovation is about.
Listeners may contact Jack Trout on his website at www.troutandpartners.com. One word, www.troutandpartners.com, and it's T-R-O-U-T. Russell?
So what I wish you had asked me is, well, what do we do with all this information? How do we execute? What I want to share is that activating others' emotional triggers is not an event. It is a process. It's a process of doing your homework, the planning, and the heavy lifting. And there are several things that you've got to do to execute this process. The first should be readily apparent. You've got to define your persuasion goal. Precisely, what do you want to accomplish with your partner? Make that goal clear, make it measurable, and give it a timeline. Next, determine which triggers and which trigger elements are best suited for each contact. Next, you want to conduct a value profile to learn exactly what your partner wants and values. Activate the requisite triggers that you have selected in your preparation work. Anticipate objections, because guess what? You're going to get them, and prepare the answers. And finally, close the deal. Focus on the goal. Research documents that fully 63% of all persuasion attempts end without request for specific action. Hey, that's criminal. You now possess the hard science to persuade any result, to achieve any goal you have. The power to influence is in your hands. Wisely apply that power, and you will achieve your destiny. Power, wealth, and influence. Persuaders rule. They wield enormous power. They always have. They always will.
For everyone listening, it is Russell Granger. You can find him on his website at www.7triggerssmallbiz.com. One word, www.7triggerssmallbiz.com. And his book is 7 Triggers to Yes. All right, Stephen.
First of all, this is a great question, and you've asked some wonderful questions, and this is the license to thrill. It's a great question. I would say this. I get this frequently from leaders as I'm working with them, CEOs of companies, entrepreneurs, and it's some derivative of this. It's, you know, Can you really do something about this? Do you behave in ways that build trust? Because you can't talk yourself out of a problem that you behaved yourself into. Mm-hmm. So if you've lost trust with somebody, you can't just talk your way out of it. The only way out is to behave your way out of it. So your behavior matters. What you do, how you do it, it matters. And my point is this. You can move the needle on trust. It's not just a, you know, something you have or you don't. That's your starting place. And you might be, there might be low trust in a relationship or in a culture or in a company. You know, maybe that's your starting point, that there's low trust. But you can do a whole lot about it. You can get good at this. You can turn it into your greatest strength. You can go after it deliberately. You can turn it into a skill, into a competency, the ability to engender trust, to create it, to establish it, to grow it, to extend it, and sometimes even, where needed, to restore it. And how will you do that? You'll ultimately do it through focusing on credibility and behavior. And that's why I go in great depth in the Speed of Trust book into the 13 behaviors common to high-trust people, high-trust leaders, high-trust companies. These are things they do and how they do them. You know, things like talking straight, behaviors like talking straight and listening first and clarifying expectations and righting wrongs and showing loyalty and practicing accountability and extending trust, etc. So things like that. They learn to do it. They do it well. And what happens is they learn, you know what? Trust matters. You can measure trust and you can move it. You can move the needle on this. You can get better on this. And when you do, everything else is affected. Go to our website, speedoftrust.com, speedoftrust.com, and you'll find a whole variety of tools and things that can help you, complementary, that you can do self-assessments of how credible you are and how trusted you are. You know, we got this little measurement tool that's free, and you can see how trusted you are with you know, different stakeholders.
Bert?
Well, I love tactics. I mean, we could talk about, you know, the six behavioral skills or how to avoid PowerPoint abuse or any of those things, but that I actually like this kind of a question. And I do have one. And it's a question that I ask people, and I'll act as if you ask me as well, because I think it's the core question that we ultimately get to in our life. It would be, very simply, what drives you? And if somebody answers that, first of all, if somebody says, gee, I'm not sure, well, it's time to think about what drives you. If you ask me what drives me, I'm very clear about it because I've thought about this a lot, and there are various aspects to it. But everybody at some point has a worldview and has a value base. Some people it's just to make money. Some people it is to have power. Some people it's addictive, whether it's you know, drugs, alcohol, or sex. That those are things that often drive unconsciously. But I think if you take a look at what drives you, and my answer to what drives me, and I think it's probably similar to most entrepreneurs' answers, or at least a piece of it, it is putting things together in new ways to achieve something. What I'm doing to please myself is creating things. And now, at my experience and age level, the most exciting thing is working with other people and helping them create themselves, guiding them, coaching them along the way. So I think that's a perhaps long answer to the question of what drives you, but I think everybody has to ask themselves that question. And you know, Jay, passion comes from the core values that we have and the core goals, like in this case, achieving, putting things together in new ways. That's when our passion comes from that. Because if we're just doing something because it's a good thing to do, and then that includes making money. I think we all want to make money. I want to make a lot of money, but it's not to make a lot of money to go buy things. It's to make a lot of money to use it to influence more. I mean, it becomes a highly leveraged goal. Our website, our corporate website, with all the information that I've been talking about in courses and video and before and after examples, is at Decker.com, www.decker.com. The blog is deckerblog.com, and it also links to a lot of other blogs and good information and such.
Kevin, give us your answer.
one of the cool things about being able to be out in the public a lot, excuse me, and do seminars is that people do come up at the end and they say, hey, Kev, you know what? You're really pretty good up there on stage, but you know what? I don't present myself as well. I'm sort of just like the, you know, the shy, humble country boy, and I don't really have that strong presence that you do. I come off as being, you know, like pushy, and I'm a sort of a concern, and I look like I'm afraid when I'm trying to make a sale. And I, you know, but the fact is that I'm knowledgeable and I'm caring and I do care about my customers and I am, you know, I've got my PhD or my MD or whatever it is, and yet I'm still perceived as sort of being like shady or a shark and trying to push products on people. And I think that would be the question. The thing is that you want to literally look at yourself as being just a little bit more successful than you are right now, because people are so concerned. They come off as being afraid, and they push when they're afraid. You push for sales. You push, you know, your limits in marketing and your claims and credibility when you're afraid. And you can come back and back off of that and not make those amazing, you know, I can cure acne in one day while you lose 100 pounds overnight, while we make you a multi-trillionaire, not in Zimbabwe. And it's all going to happen tomorrow morning. What it has to come down to is if the sale doesn't close, who cares? You're walking away, you're going home, and it's the end of the day. And don't worry about it. And as soon as you're there, people will do business with you, and they'll seek you out. We're never going to be Starbucks, but we're not trying to be. We're trying to do this instead, and just say what it is. And don't have to try to make excuses when you have a claim that is modest, and then you do the proverbial thing that Jay Abraham talks about a lot, which is over-deliver. I recommend people think about that. What's unique about you? You don't need to be as amazing as Starbucks. And cool is that you can be Apple and have 7% of the business and have the most amazing product on the planet. And that could be you.
That's great. That's great. This is the next one, Kevin. If anyone, and hopefully everyone, is provoked favorably enough that they want to know more, how would they reach you?
KevinHogan.com. Stop off and say hello. There's an email link on every page, KevinHogan.com.
All right, Mike, let's hear your perspective.
Well, the question that I would want you to ask me is, what is the top 13% doing so much better than the bottom 87%? And the answer is, boy, if we knew that, it'd really be great. But they intuitively bond better with their buyer. And if you really look at it, they've got a level of emotional trust that's far superior to the bottom 87%. And I... doing some research recently with a guy who studied mythology, I came up with some new theories. Our limbic brains have been trained for 190,000 years that if someone starts to tell us a story, some interesting unconscious things happen. One, we start to relax because we think, gee, this is a story. But on the other hand, it must be important because it's coming in the form of a story. And all the important things people have learned for 190,000 years have come through story.
Yep.
And that the person telling it is probably a leader. Because if you think about it, there's story listeners and storytellers. And the storytellers are in a much smaller group. Probably of all those human beings, 13% were storytellers and 87% were story listeners. And what I believe the key skill that people who can tell stories is they emotionally connect with the buyer because they're hitting both sides of their brain. The new book, and I think we're going to turn it into an internet business, is we're going to talk about story and we're going to give salespeople story kits by vertical. So if you're an enterprise business, a business salesperson, there'll be a story kit. If you're an entrepreneur, there'll be a story kit. We're going to arm them with all the stories they need to facilitate the buyer's left brain and right brain together through their buy cycle.
I don't know enough about your more public business activities, but is there a way that everyone listening who had any interest in either seeking you out or getting more of your information or just getting part of your community that could do that?
Absolutely. I'm revamping MikeBosworth.com, and that should be fully revamped in probably 3 to 4 weeks. My email is mtb mtbent@gmail.com. MTBENT is for Michael T. Bosworth Enterprises at gmail.com.
Okay, we just concluded what I really believe is one of the most important panels you're probably going to listen to in this series, and it certainly is a wonderful, wonderful panel experience to start out with. However, and this is a very big however, you've listened, hopefully you've taken it all in. It's challenged, provoked, and stimulated your mind, your psyche, your sense of possibility. But are you grasping everything that these profound experts really said? Have you been able to grasp what really is the combined message below the surface? Do you recognize the overlapping similarities and commonalities that have emerged from the seven questions and all the experts' differing but similar answers? Maybe, maybe not. But Rich and I are committed in this experience for you to get the absolute most actionability, transactional benefit, not just intellectual entertainment. So what we're going to do now for 15 to 30 minutes is give you our combined interpretation, our assessment of what we heard and what we think as your champions, as your advocates, as your Sherpas, as your guides in the process, you should most take out of what you heard and you should do most immediately with what was said. And in order to really set the stage right, we're a little different in our attitudes. Rich and I are a little different in our skill set. So we're both going to come at this. We're going to try to do it collaboratively. We may be right on similar roads. We may differ somewhat. We may cross an overlap. We don't know what's going to come out of it, but we can promise that at the end of this, you'll have a greater understanding of what you can do to act, profit, and really benefit the most from what you've listened to this previous 90 minutes. So, Rich, why don't you start by giving everybody your interpretation of what you think the big overlaying message, the big action, everything that you think, and then I'll basically jump in continuously, and we'll go back and forth.
Okay, Doug. All right, so what I take away as being the overlaying theme of what we've just heard from all these different experts is really this idea, this concept, that marketing is more a conversation or a commitment than it is a campaign. And that conversation, that commitment, goes through some predictable stages. The first stage would be listening. You could call it a strategic conversation, and this would be strategic listening. And the strategic listening touches on lots of different areas. It touches on, one, understanding who your competitors are and the conversations that they're having about their claims, their credentials, what makes them unique, and seeing where that puts you. Where are you unique? What's your claim? What are your credentials to back up that claim? It's also about understanding your prospects and their desires and their frustrations and really getting a handle on who you're talking to and what makes them tick and what are they all about. And then lastly, who are the influencers in the market and what do they have to say and what is it that they say that resonates with the prospects that you're going after? So that would really be what I would consider strategic listening. And Joseph Jaffe talked about some ways to kind of automate that with Google Alerts and Yahoo Alerts and really staying abreast of the conversations that are going on in the marketplace. I think once you have that, once you've done that first level of listening, I think then you can develop your unique point of view of really what you see as being different about yourself and your company that is a benefit, a big benefit to the marketplace and your prospects. And that's what Jack Trout was talking about when he talked about differentiation and really backing that up with credentials and not just claims. Along those lines, with your unique point of view, Bert Decker talked about the elevator pitch, about really condensing down your differentiation into a 30-second or 60-second soundbite that really is all about the benefit that you provide that no one else can provide because it's what makes you unique and different. I think also, and lastly, in this strategic listening stage, you can figure out better who you are as a contrast to what's already being said. And along those lines, your stories, your uniqueness, not just at work and what you deliver, but you yourself personally. You know, I think it was Russell Granger who talked about that question, what do you do when you're not working so hard? He asked that to a prospect or to a doctor, but that, yeah, it was a doctor, I think, who he wanted to get an operation from. But nonetheless, you need to understand that about yourself, because that then will lead into what I see as almost like stage two of the strategic conversation, which is really starting the dialogue. Now, before I give you my perspective on that, Jay, did you want to jump in on what I said, or do you want me to just continue and then you'll...
I like what you said, and I agree. I think that it's important to establish right now that we have a diversity of business types on this this session, and they're really interesting because they range from being online, offline, product, service, professional, low price, high price, one call, multi call, and so I think you've got to be able to expand your interpretation to all this to start with what Rich said and what I think is the big message. If you're in business for the long term, you're having a permanent, ongoing, evolving relationship with people. That relationship can be interpreted as a conversation. You can't have a conversation that's intimate and meaningful if you don't know who you're talking to. If you know who you're talking to, you got to know who they are, what their tastes are, what they like, what they don't like. You've got to know not only about you and your product, but you've got to know, as Rich said, about your competition. You've got to be able to really clearly not just express but deliver on whatever it is that is the differentiating, distinguishing factor. You've got to have confidence in yourself and in your product, and you've got to live in the mindset of seeing that product transforming or protecting or enhancing the lives of the people you're working with or you're selling to, and it's very important. And this concept of trust, I think, that Stephen, I mean, it was very interesting and impactful to me that virtually all the people in a bizarrely wonderful way said about the same thing, but they said it very differently, and at least in my interpretation, Rich, and it applies to your ads, to your communication, but that's superficial. What it applies to is the relationship you are committed to have with your marketplace on an ongoing basis, and I think that's very critical that they recognize that you're committing to having a wonderful, intimate, lifelong relationship with that prospect, that buyer, where you are setting yourself up to be, you know, a benefactor in some way that differentiates from the alternatives they've got. And you know what it is, and they know what it is, and you are so trusting in your ability to deliver that, and whatever you say you're going to do, you do, because they're going to judge you accordingly. And if you ever don't, you're going to fess up to it and acknowledge it and make it right. I think that's just some really fundamental things, but I don't want to get tangential, Rich.
No, I don't think, I think I agree with you. Not I think, I do agree with you completely. I don't think it's off tangent at all. Did you want to continue, or did you want me to?
Well, I mean, it's you're doing, I mean, what I want to do, I like building on your modules because, and Rich and I had some conversation, everyone, before we did this. This is a new, just like this is a breakthrough in what we're doing, the expert panels all addressing a big theme in seven questions. This is very breakthrough and very unprecedented for Rich and I. We're not used to doing this, and we come at it with different disciplines, different wired minds. So it's actually a fun thing, and neither of us are perfect. And I'm liking in this one following his lead and building or expanding or even not challenging, but you know, diverting a bit from the modules he uses. But go with your next segment. Go ahead.
All right, so then along the same lines, after you've done that listening, which, you know, we could have a whole call on just methodologies and tactics to listen, and, you know, ultimately what I think you have to really do is just kind of gauge yourself of where you are currently. Are you really listening to the claims and credentials of your competitors? Are you really listening to the frustrations, challenges, desires of your prospects? Are you really listening to the influencers? And do a self-check, and if you're not, then you know, the methods and tactics to do that are relatively easy, you know, from your competitors, and all you have to do is go to their websites, see their advertising, what are they saying their point of difference is, from the prospects that's using forums and groups, and really getting deep into it and looking at what's being said, what are the problems that people are asking for advice on, et cetera. And the influencers is going to like sites like Technorati or Google Blog Search and finding blogs that are in your space and seeing which ones are the ones that are most popular and get the most comments and reading those comments and getting more clarity not only about the influencers but about the market itself. And so that's really the strategic listening side. Now, once you've gotten through that, then the next stage is really starting the conversation or jumping into the conversation that's already going on. And I thought along those lines, Joseph Jaffe had this great comment, which I wrote down, which was, why would you not join a conversation that you have a unique point of view about, that you could absolutely add value with your perspective on, that if you did participate, you would be a key player? And I think that that's ultimately almost a self-check of whether you're in the right market or not, because if you don't have that passion and you don't have that feeling that you can add value to the conversation, then it's questionable why you have a business in that space in the first place. But having said that, you need to start conversing, whether it's starting a brand new conversation or jumping into the conversation. Along those lines of the conversation of marketing is there are several things I wrote down. One is that you have to declare, you know, along the lines of what Stephen Covey talked about, you have to declare your intent about what it is that you see as your, you know, your role, your responsibility, and then making sure that once you've declared it, that you back that up with action so that there is that cycle of upwards trust, of you stating what you're all about and then consistently backing that up and letting people, making sure actually, not letting people, but making sure people are aware of every commitment that you've made to them that you have delivered on so that you don't lose ground because you don't remind people of the fact that you said this and you did this. And along those lines, some of the things that are kind of covered in this idea of starting this dialogue is that you have many touch points, whether it's touch points at the beginning of a sales process, whether people are going to your sales letters, your blogs, your business offline, they're walking into your store. There's many touch points. And during those touch points, what you need to do, what you need to accomplish is, one, you need to consistently articulate your point of difference and back that up with credentials. You need to state your intent and make sure you deliver on it in a way that increases the bonding and trust. And then the other thing that I think has immense value, this what Mike Bosworth said, which was, think about the predictable conversations around the products that or services that you provide, and think about the predictable conversations around the usage of your product or lack thereof, and then brainstorm how life would be different with your product or service. And that really starts if you think through that and you do that and you do that brainstorming, you really start to build up an arsenal, for lack of a better word, of stories and messages that really move people forward into the buying process, which I think is part of the intent of having this dialogue or conversation, is that you meet people wherever they are, you converse with them, you get feedback based on surveys, based on response rates, based on what other people have to say about your blog posts or your podcast or however you or your advertisements, however you get your message out, and you're consistently tweaking this conversation, your messaging, based on that feedback that you get, but that you realize that ultimately that how you win trust and how you get people to choose you is through a dialogue that really is focused on them, that really states your role in their guidance, their support, their ultimate benefit, and that you progress forward on that message in a consistent way throughout all your messaging, throughout all your touch points, throughout every interaction that the prospect, customer, than client has with you and your company. And I wish I know that there was more that was said about this throughout the panel, and I wish I could have more nuggets, but I kind of got lost in that thought while everybody was talking. And so I'm hoping, Jay, that you can add some more oomph to what I just said.
I hope so. But you did a very, very good job. I made a couple notes, but I don't know if I'm going to take it exactly. One of the things I'll say, and it's not a self-serving, but those of you who, who have access to re-listen to this, I encourage you to do it many times because you will get another dimension every time you do it. But for those that you don't, we're going to do our very best right here for you. Rich said something I want to make just absolutely explicit, not implicit, that what we're talking about, what each expert talked about, is to be incorporated, translated, extrapolated into whatever form of marketing, communication, strategic marketing communication you do. So we don't want you sitting there going, I'm not online, so I can't have a conversation with the market. Au contraire, you can have a conversation with your market when they come in. You can have a conversation with your market after they buy. You can have a conversation with your market after they don't buy. You can have a conversation with a segment of your market when they buy from competitors. You can do anything and everything, but these mechanisms we're talking about, these strategic filaments, as you integrate them, they need to be integrated, as Rich said, in your sales approach, in your advertising, but more important than all of that, because that's superficial if it doesn't first and foremost get integrated into your whole belief system, your ideology. And I teach something called the strategy of preeminence, but it's about the same thing. You want to be seen as their most trusted advisor for life, and you can't be the most trusted if you can't be trusted. You got to trust yourself that what you're doing for your market is better than your competition in whatever area of differentiation you're doing it in. You got to know that you really are congruent with what you're saying. You got to know that what you're saying is what they want, and the only way you're going to do that is to get feedback, however you get feedback. I was so very impressed with the fact that almost all of them said variants of the same thing. They just came at it very differently. And credentializing yourself is very interesting because a lot of you are far more expert and far more impressive than you recognize and acknowledge, and some of you are less. If you're more, then by all means, relish it. Exploit it ethically. You know, embrace it. If you're not, don't be forlorn and depressed. Refine it. Make yourself more expert because that's how you will achieve and exceed whatever commonality the competition has, and you'll be able to differentiate, credentialize yourself. I wrote down something very interesting, and it translates to all of you, but it comes from an experience that I learned years ago, because I always pick the minds of incredible experts in every definition and area that I can find. And a man who was the top man in platform selling a few years ago, I interviewed for a couple of hours, and he had a very simple philosophy, and he said, it's not manipulative. Tell them exactly what you're going to do in that session. Tell them why you're doing it. Tell them what they can expect. Tell them what they'll get out of it. And then deliver on your promises and ask them at the end to judge you accordingly, which is not dissimilar to what Stephen Covey said. He took it down a different route. But that's a pretty impressive formula for marketing, for selling, for interacting, for website creation. I just want you to think about that. I also wrote down, let me read what I wrote down, hold on. You got to have, and one of the things that came across, and it's true, if you don't believe it, there's a very fine line in life between arrogance, egotism, and certainty and confidence. If you don't come into it with certainty and confidence, you can't expect your marketplace to have certainty, confidence, and yes, trust in you. And so you got to question and do a self-diagnostic test of these issues these people are talking about. And what I would do if I were you, and hopefully you took great notes, and if you didn't, hopefully you're one of the people that are getting the transcription and the action version, but I'd go through every one of those notes, and then I'd take them out, and I'd have the high points that I wrote down, and I'd say, how am I incorporating these points in everything I'm doing, or am I? And if you are, I would question how well you're integrating them and articulating them. If you're not, I would immediately look at the gaps and be filling them. And I mean, I thought that the best part about this, frankly, and it's really one of the most liberating elements of doing business the way I think I do it, and I know Rich does it, and I hope that you will do it, is that we really love the people we try to help. Now, does that mean that every one of them we would have in our home for dinner? No, of course not. But we really and truly, we feel for them, we hope for them, we want them to have better lives, we want them to struggle less, we want them to have more joy, more prosperity, achieve more, because we automatically assume that they offer incredible value to their marketplace. And if you can basically start loving the people you're serving, then you're going to want to know more about them than just the superficial. You're going to want to know, you want to put a face and a vision and dimension, and you're going to think of them not just as a buyer, but of a man and a woman and a father and a mother, someone with hopes and dreams and needs and fears. And that dimensionalization added to the distinction, the differentiation that you incorporate into your positioning is going to be very, very, very powerful and a decisive advantage for you. And I may be on a tangent. Rich, you're welcome to challenge me because I'm just sort of babbling a little bit here.
No, I agree 100%. And along those lines, let me just pick up on what you said, one of the last things you said, because I think that's really how the ideas in this panel get translated into business growth, and that is to really look at all of the different suggestions and recommendations that these experts conveyed here, and really look at your own marketing, look at your own process, and ask yourself, am I doing this now, yes or no? And if I were to do this in a more active way, a more result-certain way, what would change? So along those lines, like Joseph Jaffe talked about acknowledging what you've heard from the market. Like, how do you do that now? Do you, you know, do you do enough of it? Stephen Covey talked about, you know, the two components of trust, character and competence, and character being honesty and truthfulness. Well, how do you convey that? And how do you convey that in your marketing currently? And is it enough? And in competence, it's capabilities and past performance. How do you broadcast your capabilities and your past performance? How do you, this is a word that you use sometimes, Jay. How do you really program customers or prospects to tell them what you're going to do, tell them what you expect them to do, and how the game is going to be played, and why and when and how you want to be judged? And how do you do that in your marketing? Are you doing it now? If not, how can you interject that? And, you know, one of the things, Jay and I, you know, we've done this. We did a program a while back called the Maven Program, which we really taught people how to become the go-to experts in their market. And one of the ideas in that program that we recommended to all of our clients in that program was to start building your list of personal stories where, you know, stories that have happened to you over the course of your life that convey who you are, convey what you're all about, convey why you're in the business that you're in, convey why you're so committed to your client's success or results, why you chose the market that you're in, et cetera. And over time, building that data bank of stories that you can share with others so that when they're documented, they're not as easily forgotten. And so along those lines, looking at all the great knowledge that these experts provided, and think about, really, at the end of the day, how are you going to convey your uniqueness of all of those elements to your marketplace? And that's really the big question mark I have in my mind about how you'll get the biggest and best value out of this call, is by taking the time to actually do that. And if you do that, I'm positive that you will become, the de facto choice in your market. And if you don't do that, then this has been nothing other than intellectual entertainment. And so this is where the rubber really meets the road. And if you're serious about growing your business, then what you need to do is you need to start laying out some of these communications that you want to have with your marketplace that will ultimately bond you closer with them and ultimately get them to choose you over everyone else, which was the intent of this call, getting your prospects, getting your clients to choose you over everyone else. And what I believe I'm saying and what I believe this panel was about a conversation that makes that happen. And that conversation only happens if you're prepared for it. And the way you prepare for it is by dissecting the recommendations that these experts made and incorporating them into your marketing material, so to speak.
Can I add?
Please do.
Okay. Well, I want to pick up on something that's a little, it's going to be a little cheeky, but it's really meant to be a profound, realization. Rich said if you're serious about growing your business. Well, if you're not serious about growing your business, since nothing in life is static, then you must be very serious about really destroying your business, because you can't go one, you're going to either go one way or the other. So if you think about it, if you're not committed to do the kind of things we're talking about here, you're very seriously committed to undoing whatever you've built up and whatever time you've been in whatever business you're in, and that's an eerie realization, isn't it, Rich?
It's one that many people don't ever want to address, that's for damn sure.
That's the first thing. The second, and you have, and it's totally tangential, but it's totally relevant. Rich was sharing very intriguingly to me a new project he's working on. He was talking about, if I may use a word without embarrassing you, the gap.
Uh-huh, sure.
He was talking about how most people don't realize they want instant gratification, and they don't realize how hard they work at avoiding doing something that's going to be so much better, and it's more effort to avoid it than to do it. What we're trying to do in all of the interview panels you will be exposed to, and what we're trying to do with all the questions that we pose, and what we're trying to do with the quality of experts we've sought out for you, and we're definitely trying to do with the post-interview wrap-up, interpretive sort of distillation that Rich and I are doing, is to make it absolutely infallibly clear for you what to do with this, how to take action with this, how to translate it to something which will transform the future of your business in the most liberating and joyous and prosperous way. And I mean, I'm just looking through, and Rich and I have distilled notes here, and we look at it differently, but I mean, how much more fun is life if everybody's your friend? How much more fun is it if you really take the time to be the best you can be? And the best you can be comes from basically getting feedback, listening, hearing, respecting. One of the things that Michael Bosworth said, and I really like it, and it's something I've done for years, is I spend an enormous amount of time before I ever sit down to strategically create any kind of a marketing process to think about what that recipient, whether that recipient is getting a letter, watching an ad or an infomercial, being presented live or by phone by a salesman or woman, reading a website, a blog, what are they thinking, not just in the macro, but you know, stage by stage, what thoughts are coming to mind, what questions, what what confusions, and I want to address that, and I think about it, and I try to humanly respect the fact that I recognize that they're struggling with that or they're experiencing that. And the closer you get to understanding the thinking, and not just the business basis, but the human basis of why people are doing things, the more powerfully connected you'll be with them, but not just how powerful in an autocratic control, you know, sort of a automatron way, you're going to have such a greater joy of living and being in business, and that's such a refreshing promise in a time when business can be very stressful. This is going to really relieve a lot of the stress for you. But keep in mind, it starts with a strategic long-term commitment. This is how we are going to enjoy our relationship with you for life. We're going to be there through the good and the bad. You are our friend. We are going to respect you. We are going to tell you what you can expect from us. We will deliver on it. If ever we don't, we expect you to call us out. If ever we don't add value beyond the value you can get somewhere else, we don't deserve it. We know what you want because we've heard, we've listened, we've asked. That is, and you can express that in your sales approaches. You can express that in your interactions with them. You can express that in post-purchase communication, whether you follow up, whether you send them a letter, whether you send them an email, whether you go visit them. I mean, if you can appreciate what Rich and I are trying to do for you and your business, no matter where it resides and how it is transacted, we're trying to not just enrich you, we're trying to liberate you. We're trying to release you from the shackles of mediocrity, of stress, of uncertainty, and make the process of doing business, of adding value, of connecting with people at a much higher, deeper, richer, more sustaining level than any of your competitors can in the area that you concentrate in, much, much, much more successful, effective, and sustainable. And I just think that's really the big part of this. A couple other things, and let me just go through because I'm not as clear on my notes as Rich is, and I have to review because there was something else. I mean, I really love that quote, Rich. Remind me that Stephen Covey had, so I don't have to find it, that you can't talk your way out of something that you what?
You can't talk your way out of a problem that you behaved your way into.
So let's take that for a minute because I've got a belief, even in a bad economy, there's plenty of business out there. You just have to take it from the people who don't understand these elements that these very, 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 very profound experts shared today and that hopefully Rich and I have interpreted. But you got to realize that where you are right now, it has far less to do with the economy than it probably has to do with you never recognizing the power process of really leading and controlling your business sector. Now you understand that. So you can't just wish for it. You've got to transactionalize it. You've got to do what it takes. And the first thing is basically understand who your market is, understanding what they want, understand what you can bring them that is different, superior, better, more desirable. Understand how you have to demonstrate to them that you really do provide that. Understand that you've got to be able to understand what their perception is going to be and overcome it if it's not going to be as strong as you'd like. And the way to overcome it is, first of all, with truth and credibility. Second is with recognition that they're more than just a superficial customer. They're a man or woman. They can easily and should joyously be your friend. And third, that you got to constantly get collaborative feedback from them. But, I mean, I think the key is that all this translates to any form of selling, marketing you do, but it's bigger and it's much more global than that. It should be the foundation of the dimensionalized and highly enriched culture that you build your business on starting today and going forward. And that's all I have, Rich.
Well, I think that sums it up then. So I think we're done with this panel then.
Okay, everybody. Hopefully you got an enormous amount of clarity out of each expert's answer to each question. Hopefully you're going to constantly now be focused on the big, big issue about getting buyers to always choose you over everyone else, and there's a caveat, when it's appropriate, because they're not always the right, you're not always the right decision, and you got to recognize that. However, we hope that this is the beginning of an extraordinary journey we're going to enjoy with you for years to come. Rich and I have some of the most extraordinary, amazing, intelligent, profound experts and thinkers on the docket for the upcoming panels, and the topics we're going to address, and the questions we're going to ask, and the answers we're going to receive and the interpretations that Rich and I are committed to providing you are designed to each and every week make your business better off because we're in your life. We hope we're delivering. We look forward to the next panel with you. As I said, if you're one of the people who've got access to this over and over again, I would listen many times. If you're somebody that's got the transcription and the action notes, I definitely follow them. If you didn't, I hope you took great notes, and I hope that you don't just put the notes somewhere passively. That expertise is only as good as the actions you take with them. And we've gotten you literally world-class experts. We've tried to get you world-class interpretations that were moving mountains to share with you. What you do with it is up to you. Good luck. Thanks, Rich.